Hello again. It's a great honor to welcome Jutta Horstmann, who will deliver our keynote this year. He has a long-standing connection to Frostcon and has visited us many times, and is a founder, entrepreneur, and currently the interim CEO of Mailvelop, so also has a company background. And she will talk to us about running the internet underfunded and understaffed, and how we hopefully can achieve a sustainable open source ecosystem. So the stage is yours.
Thank you for the warm welcome, and yeah, welcome to all of you. I hope you had the opportunity to grab some lunch, and I hope that I will be able to deliver a keynote that is interesting enough so that you can overcome the lunch coma. A warm welcome as well to the people watching this stream. Thanks a lot to the Chaos Communication Club media streaming. As I always used to say, the best conferences have a beckoning cat. So I'm very happy that I will be accompanied by this one and also that the streaming is set up. So yes, the title of my talk is Running the Internet Underfunded and Understaffed, How to Achieve a Sustainable Open Source Ecosystem, and that title is quite a mouthful. So let's break it down a bit. This is about, in a nutshell, how to create open source software while still being able to make a living. With economic sustainability, I mean that the project has funding to continue operations for years to come. So it is not about having financial sustainability for the next 2 or 3 months. It is about being able to plan long-term and strategically. So today I want to discuss sustainable business and funding models for open source projects. But for now, let's not make this too academic, because this is personal. For me, because over the last 20 years, I built my career on open source software, building and scaling successful companies based on it. Now, back in 2006, and incidentally, that's the same year that Frostcon was incubated, I founded my own open source development agency, implementing projects for clients in the public and private sector. We built our projects on a standard LAMP stack, and with some forays into Plone and GeForge, MediaWiki, and also custom software development, we settled onto Drupal, becoming one of the major providers of Drupal-based solutions in Germany. Now, that was quite a sustainable business model, and it sustained a team of 15 highly skilled employees over many years. Many of them you see here in the pictures, also attending our booth at Frostcon a couple of times. And yes, that's John Maddock Hall lounging on one of our events here. And also you see the techies coming over to grab all of our fortune cookies. But how did we contribute to sustaining the open source projects we built our success on? At Data in Transit, we applied a mix of various contributions. For Drupal, we attended hackathons, we sponsored events and marketing material, we evangelized with our clients, we shared knowledge, and we supported the Drupal Association with our membership fee. For other parts of our stack, though, we definitely cared too little for the shoulders we were standing on, simply taking for granted the existence of a wealth of supporting code, tools, and knowledge. We did not give anything back from the revenues we created, making use of other people's work. Fast forward 10 years, when I led IO, an international software company, as their COO and CTO. Luckily, the question of how to... I was in charge of a proper open source project, namely AdBlock Plus. And luckily, the question of how to sustain that project had already been solved in 2011, when IO as a company was set up by the project maintainer, Vladimir Palland, and his two co-founders. Letting ads that comply with the acceptable ads criteria pass through the ad blocker, and charging a service fee for allow listing them to the websites running the ads allowed for a profitable business model from the start. And additionally, individual users of AdBlock Plus were willing to donate to the project and later also to buy a premium subscription to get access to advanced features. So, well done, IO. But finding such an ingenious business model is rare. So currently, I focus on supporting other projects that are still looking for ways to long-term sustainability. Now, MailVelop, which I'm currently leading as their interim CEO, is a great showcase for the challenges that open source projects face with regards to their long-term sustainability. As a solution to easily encrypt web mailers, it's been on the market for over 10 years now. While being web mailer agnostic, that means you can use it with any mail client running in a desktop browser, it is also integrated by all major German web mailers such as Web.de or GMX, Posteo, Freenet, as their encryption offering of choice. The German Federal Office for Information Security, the BSI, uses this technology to encrypt its own de-mail offering. And dozens of international news outlets suggest their sources to use MailVelop as their mail encryption tool of choice to ensure the confidentiality of their communication. For example, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, and the Zeit. Still, MailVelop has been run most of the time by a small team of three people with less than two full-time employees and with only one developer. The project is funded based on grants and a small income from its premium offering, MailVelop Business, featuring a Google Workspace integration. There is zero income generated from the third parties building their tools and offerings on it. Now, if that one developer would be run over by a bus, burn out, retire, or simply move on, the German web mailers would lose their encryption functionality, and most news outlets would lose their capability to communicate securely with their sources. Luckily, all of this did not happen yet, and hopefully never will. But do we want to build our tools, businesses, and infrastructure on hopes? Now, this is the point where in all ramblings about the dire state of open source sustainability, this seminal XKCD cartoon has to be shown. And I've been talking a couple of weeks ago with a member of the German Sovereign Tech Fund who told me that they are using this one here as their bad signal. So whenever it shows up on the web or in a slide, they know they have to come to the rescue. I want to use it as a segue to take you with me on a journey coming from my own experiences that I just shared to a broader evaluation of the state of economic sustainability for open source projects. Because we find the pattern of MailVelop case in many parts of the open source ecosystem. Like this year, we see the 10th anniversary of the disclosure of Heartbleed, an OpenSSL bug allowing for massive exploit of that key encryption library. At the time of disclosure, around 17% of the internet secure web servers, which was around 500,000, were believed to be vulnerable to that attack. It allowed the theft of the server's private keys and the user's session cookies and passwords, making this the worst vulnerability found since commercial traffic began to flow on the internet, quoting Wikipedia. When Heartbleed was discovered, OpenSSL was maintained by a handful of volunteers, only one of whom worked full-time. And yearly donations to the OpenSSL projects were about $2,000. So, The mystery is not that a few overworked volunteers missed that bug. The mystery is why it hasn't happened more often, quoting Steve McCaskey, COO of OpenSSL. And OpenSSL was and still is only one of many examples of that problem of running the internet underfunding and understaffed. Only a year later, after OpenSSL, GnuPG and its maintainer Werner Koch made the headlines, announcing he would have to discontinue developing GnuPG as he had no funds left. Now, these events led to some shifts in the ecosystem, and you might have seen in the exhibition space Werner Koch with his company G10 being quite in a good state nowadays. And back then, a couple of big tech players stepped up and donated at least a tiny bit of their revenues to help the struggling projects. Also, a lot of funds were set up, like the Core Infrastructure Initiatives, and the US Congress funded Open Technology Fund. In Germany, the Sovereign Tech Fund was set up, and GitHub opened their GitHub Sponsors project. Still. The same situation only 3 years ago when major Log4j vulnerabilities were discovered. The project was maintained by a team of 3 developers on a part-time basis. They had, back then, already a GitHub sponsorship page set up for the project, which featured 3 small-size sponsors earning barely enough to buy the team a round of coffees. And this February, the Ixiutils backdoor. The project being maintained by a single person with health issues, working on the project as an unpaid hobbyist, willing to accept help from a fraudulent contributor. So, history keeps repeating, and it will continue to do so as long as the core problem of funding open source software is not solved across the whole ecosystem. Like we see in recent surveys, the Open Source Security Report of this year and last year's Tidelift study, that nowadays, in that survey, 96% of the surveyed code bases included open source software. And 49% of these code bases had no developer activity in the past 2 years. And 60% of open source maintainers surveyed described themselves as unpaid hobbyists, with 44% of them saying that they are the only person maintaining a project. Now, this means that with the current setup, there is still a huge risk involved in building infrastructure on open source software. And the same goes for any key processes in companies or society, like encrypted communication, ad blocking, or web browsing. And as we want to promote the use of open source software, we need to address this risk and solve the puzzle of how to make a living from building open source software. Now, to get a clearer perspective, let's look a bit into the economics of open source. So let's first visit open source happy land. This is what we tell others when we want to advocate for open source software. At its core, creating open source software is a non-commercial, sometimes even anti-commercial act. It is about voluntary, unpaid work, which is good because it is about individuals scratching their own itch and others contributing if they find the code useful. And by that, they are improving the quality as, given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Also, the results are highly innovative due to the collective intelligence unlocked by collaboration and knowledge sharing. And the user experience is just awesome, as all users can be contributors and participate directly in the improvement of the software. Now, that's the theory. In practice, attracting more contributors creates the need for governance. contexts, meaning an organization with specific roles, structures, and processes. More users means that the number of free riders, those only using the software without contributing back, increases. While at the same time, these users ask questions, look for documentation, find unexpected ways to break the software, and they complain. To cope, some sort of user support, at least in its basic form of a public forum, needs to be set up and moderated. And all of this creates work, and it takes time, way beyond volunteering some lines of code in one's spare time. So in a nutshell, the combination of voluntarism in creating code and a not-for-profit approach to freely sharing code is only feasible for projects that are low maintenance, that is, they require little work for maintaining them and for supporting their users. Successful open source projects, now like GnuPG, on the contrary, they are work intensive, both for maintaining and developing the code, as well as for attending to its users. And with that, the voluntary not-for-profit nature of working on open source software becomes its worst enemy. With developers having to become community managers, fundraisers, customer support, it stifles innovation. It decreases the quality of the products. It burns out the maintainers and sometimes leaves them broke. And it just takes the fun out of it. Often open source projects find themselves in a vicious cycle where lack of funding leads to a lack of contributors, leading to a lack of product development, fundraising, or business development, which again aggravates the lack of funding. Now, how can we get out of that vicious cycle? Let me walk you through some of the most common business models and funding schemes and see then what we can learn from some real-world examples. Now, in this graph, I tried to map some models against two axes. On the x-axis, how the funds received can be used. So, are these unrestricted funds or restricted funds? And on the y-axis, how much effort beyond improving the software has to be spent to get funding or revenues. For the color coding here, yellow means grants or patronage models like donations, and purple means commercial solutions. Now, some examples here. For example, if there is the model of a paid contributor, for example, a paid core contributor, this is an example of restricted funds, because you can only use that money to pay that specific person. You can't use the money to pay your office rent or your cloud infrastructure. On the other side of the spectrum, if you get an award, you can do with the money whatever you want, or if you're offering paid services, again, you can invest that money even in your vacation to Mallorca or whatnot. Then looking at the x-axis, the question here is, what do I need to do to receive the money? Like, for example, again, looking at an award or donations, you have to do very little beyond working on your product or project itself. Looking on the other side of the spectrum, at paid services, here, you are not paid for developing the code. You are paid for providing services around that code, like consulting or offering it as a software as a service or whatnot. So this means that, again, working on the project itself is not refunded. Now let's look at two other criteria that will help us figure out successful funding and business models. On the left-hand side, the y-axis, there's the question, is the revenue coming from that source increasing alongside the success of the project? So success can be like number of users, for example. Or is the revenue detached from it? Like, again, the example of an award. You don't get, if you get an award once, you don't get two awards if you double your user number. The same goes for grants. On the other side of the spectrum, if you do, for example, dual licensing, so you offer your product in a paid version, or if you are funding your project via ads, the more users you have, the more money you get. So here, the revenue you receive increases with the success of your project. And then on the x-axis, the question is about the predictability. So can we be sure that we will get continued revenue from that source when we continue working on the project? Is the income predictable? Like, for example, if we have a scheme like Universal Basic Income, Bedingungsloses Grundeinkommen, or a paid contributor, we know that the next month the money will come in. In the case of an award or a grant, you have no idea, only because you received a grant this year, whether you will get another grant next year, and even more with awards. Now, what we see here is that they are currently very limited options, checking all of the boxes. So this is now this green area at the upper right side. So checking all of the boxes like unrestricted funds and getting paid for working on the project itself and growing revenues with growing the success of the project and a predictable income. But let me make this more tangible by looking at a couple of examples. Now, there's, for example, AdBlock Plus that I talked before later already. AdBlock Plus is around since 2006 already, and it is funded by a mixture of ads as paid services. So this is their acceptable ads revenue. And also they have a freemium model and they are receiving donations. Then there's Drupal. Drupal has been around since 2001 already. And they are funded, again, by a mix coming from donations. Then there are grants that are given by the Drupal Association. There are sponsorships, there are paid contributors, and there are paid services. Knupigi, that also showed up already in the talk before, it is nowadays funded by a public contract that they won for GPG for Win and the Verschlusssache desktop, which is great because now they are out of these problems that I showcased before. Also, a couple of years ago, they had a successful crowdfunding campaign. They received donations by larger tech companies like Stripe and Facebook, and they are offering paid services. Mailerlop, as said, is funded by grants from the Internews Fund and the Open Tech Fund, and also by paid subscription via the Mailerlop business product. Then there's Mozilla Firefox, around since 2004 already. It is funded by donations coming via the Mozilla Foundation, and a bit similar like AdBlock Plus, paid services via ads. So 81% of the income of Firefox is in fact coming from Google paying them for being this default search engine. And as we all know, Google's making their money via ads, so this is an ad-funded model again. Another example is MySQL, already around since 1995, and they are funded by dual licensing. They have a paid product. So what are the learnings from these success stories that have been around since decades already? I think it is that diversification is key, having a mix of non-profit and for-profit models. Longevity is in general built on a combination of keeping the organization small, like we see in Knupigi or in Mailerlop, or finding a profitable paid services business model, for example, ad serving, like AdBlock Plus is doing it, or Firefox. Another option is building a profitable paid services ecosystem like the Drupal community has been doing it. Then there is dual licensing as an option showcased by MySQL. There's also the option of securing grants, best case unrestricted or mostly unrestricted grants, like in the case of MailVelop, or securing donations, like for GNUPG and Firefox, where again it is key that the donations are relevant, that they are large. So overall, sustainability is only achieved when the income is predictable and plannable for a couple of years ahead, because only that enables long-term strategic planning, like a product roadmap, innovation, and a healthy strategy of how to attract and retain contributors. On the other hand, solutions that rely on a tip jar gig economy, that restrict funds to only building a specific feature, or one-time donations will not help in achieving sustainability. Because any code and then pray for pay schemes are always a poor substitute for a steady paycheck. It puts maintainers under risk without health and retirement benefits. Overall, getting paid for creating open source software should not be something that the maintainer should have to hope, ask, or even beg for. It should be safe, it should be long-term, and they should be properly entitled to it. Which means that as a society, we need to find ways to stop the free riding and let the creators of open source software be fairly paid for their contribution to the public good. So to complete the landscape of funding and business models that I just shared, I suggest adding two more models. One is using public money from, for example, corporate taxes to provide for a regular, unrestricted income for open source maintainers and contributors. And with that, we would address open source software as a public good, like education, safety, health, transportation, and pay contributors like we do, for example, teachers or the police. And I was very happy to read this week that the Sovereign Tech Fund in Germany is moving into that direction with setting up a fellowship program that would provide a steady income for core infrastructure maintainers. The second part that we should have a discussion on is licensing. Licensing that requires companies to pay money when they build commercial offerings on top of open source software. For that, unfortunately, there is no standard yet. So it could look like something that says, I want everyone to be able to use my code only for non-commercial purposes. Or something like the business source license that requires to publish the code, but limits its uses. Some examples as well are the Commons Clause or the Sustainable License. The mastermind behind these is the lawyer Heather Meeker. I definitely recommend to check out her work. But the thing about these new licenses is that they are not complying with the open source definition. And this means that if you as an open source project acquire one of these licenses, you're not considered open source anymore, meaning that you won't get access to specific grants anymore, and you might not be considered for in public tenders. Now, let me close this keynote with a very different aspect by highlighting one specific topic in this conversation, because I want to celebrate the awesome female contributors and maintainers of open source software. But wait. Even today, female contributors are only a tiny minority in the mostly white male ecosystem. And looking around in the audience here, I think that fact shows. But now, how is it related to our topic of economic sustainability? In general, marginalized people in tech, like women, people of color, people with disabilities, LGBTQIA people, and others, they have less free time for a few major reasons. For example, dependent care, domestic work and errands, and they have to work more to make a living due to pay inequity. Looking at Germany, women are earning 18% less than men, and we are doing 9 hours more unpaid work than men per week. 9 hours every week. Imagine we had these 9 hours to work on open source software. So how can one expect us to contribute to open source software when that requires spending spare time we don't have on another topic that we are not going to be paid for? So the question is, could efforts to increase the sustainable of free and open source software directly have effects on gender diversity? So my answer here is a big yes. If you can make a decent living from creating open source software, this will also enable and encourage women to contribute. And with that, open source sustainability is not only the key for a thriving ecosystem, it also enables diversity in our communities. That's it from my side. Very thankful for your attention, and now looking forward to your questions, also your comments. I hope that this will be a lively discussion. And if you would rather like to ask your question or give your comment in German, very welcome to do so. Either the moderator or I will repeat it in English then for everybody to understand. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for this interesting insights and raising the, I guess, more or less obvious questions about licenses, but also the not so obvious questions about diversity and equality. So there were some arms, at least one, so I'll come around.
Thanks for the great talk. At the beginning I had lots of hope, and then at the very last slide, all of a sudden, the conclusion was we need to go to the business source license, and that seems to be defeat and giving up on free software. And can you offer some hope, or is that inevitable?
I think we had a quite good conversation on that topic just 2 hours or 1 hour ago in another session that I attended, where it was about the tender process in the public service. And there, this situation was more seen as a pendulum swinging. So in the end, open source providers have to make money to make a living. And as long as there are no other good options, they tend to look into other ways of licensing, which for us as a community is a problem. But it also, I think, should encourage all of us, but also at least the government, the public institutions, to look more into ways of counter that. And I see that happening. So with the example of the Sovereign Tech Fund that I just gave, I see that there is a lot of efforts funded by public money to make sure that core pieces of internet infrastructure can stay open source and that their maintainers are sufficiently funded. And the other example is the CENDES, Zentrum für digitale Souveränität, a private company owned by the German public sector, that is also dedicated to making sure that at least the public sector gets decent open source software. So there are driving forces here. So this is why I definitely think that there is hope. And Also, I don't think that talking about licenses is a bad thing per se, because as long as the licenses as they are lead to maintainers burning out or not being sufficiently funded, we have an issue that needs to be openly discussed. It just should not lead to the fact that software becomes closed. Did that answer the question? You are still looking skeptical. Probably we can follow up later.
Actually, a follow-up to this question. So we have open source licenses that are tagged as such. And is there any way to reconcile this in the near-term future so that we can have a commercial license that requires commercial users to pay for a software, but on the other hand, also to count as a free software license that can be distributed and used in the usual ways as we are accustomed to essentially any FOSS that we are using today?
Yeah, so in fact, I'm hoping for something like that to emerge. I'm not an open source lawyer, or I have no insights into the Open Source Foundation, who is responsible for the open source definition. So I don't know what the current state and the discussion is there, but I see the dire need to do something about that. And the work of Heather Meeker that I showcased shows that there are people working on that with the idea of keeping the open source ecosystem intact while still providing better licensing to counter the bad effects that the free rider problem poses.
Thank you for your talk. I like the suggestion to start talking about politics and economy in context of taxes and distribution. However, you did not mention too much about distribution. How do we go about selecting who receives money and how much, and how to ensure that over time there is still space for new projects to appear and rebalance of interests and like technology evolves and maybe what is funded today might not be relevant in the future. So what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I share that criticism or that thought. Because looking, for example, at the policies of the Open Tech Fund and the Sovereign Tech Fund, they are quite similar in the US and in Germany. They have money to distribute, and they work a lot on making sure that it goes into the right direction and goes to the right people. But up until now, most of these grants provide the projects with the problem that there's a lot of overhead. So the first question is, do the right projects in fact receive the money? And I think at least these two examples, they are really going the extra mile to find the right projects. And you can apply for it for sure. But the other thing is how much overhead is posed on these projects to first apply for the grants and then report on the usage of the money. So here we have a problem that it is public money, so because it is paid by the taxpayers, there is an accountability to make sure that it goes in the right direction. So restricted funds and reporting is in a way necessary. And this is why I like the idea of the Sovereign Tech Fund Fellowship, that this goes just to pay a salary, like you pay the salary of a teacher or of a police officer, you pay the salary of a maintainer. And there you can showcase, just in terms of commits, for example, that you are a maintainer or contributor to a project, and then you receive a certain amount of money. An even easier option would be to provide a universal basic income. That would be something that would benefit the whole society. But I think it's a different conversation.
Thank you very much for the very nice keynote today. Since you have been asked a lot about this money, this licensing thing, I would like to focus on the diversity aspect, which you mentioned last. From my point of view, being a lecturer here at the university isn't the problem even before that. When I look into our students and the diversity in our students, we still have a huge gap, right? It's far away from 50-50. I don't have the current number with me right now, but of course you need to be educated as a programmer in computer science to become a good open source developer. So from your point of view, any ideas how we can attract more women to computer science?
So two aspects here. One is, I think what you see in the university is the same that we see as company owners, as employers. So I always say we are at the end of the food chain. So everything that is wrong in society, starting from kindergarten, starting from childcare, starting from in general discrimination in our societies, this starts with the birth of the child. And then when people move into university or if they apply for a job, most of the stuff has already gone wrong. So what we need to do as employers, as an institution like a university, is we need to become vocal about that topic. We need to start changing society with our lever that we have in heading an organization. We need to invest in programs like the Girls' Day or something like that. So there are many ways that we can use the lever we have to start at the beginning. So start at the beginning of the food chain. So that's one thought here. The other thing is that I think that especially open source software lends itself a lot to latecomers, to what is in German is the word Quereinsteiger. Quereinsteiger. So that you don't need to study computer sciences to later get into open source software. I've seen that a lot especially in female open source groups, that these were women who did not start a career in IT. I didn't. I started political sciences. But based on looking into open source software, working with Linux, I then decided to add a computer science study to my career. So I think open source software, due to its open nature, lends itself a lot also to start like in a later time in the food chain to attract women. If we change a couple of societal parameters to enable women and other marginalized groups to contribute.
And if I may, I think it's good that we have Seiteneinsteiger because it adds different perspectives into the open source community. I think here was another raised hand.
I have a question. What if a revenue source, for example, just disappears? Let's say Firefox loses the 82% from the Google, which now is accused for a monopoly, or Microsoft just drops the GitHub sponsorship. How can we protect maintainers and projects from just disappearing?
Yeah, it's a very good question that I don't have a proper answer to. So we've seen... I think it will continue to happen when there's not a diversification in means in place. This is why I highlighted that wealth of options that are there for projects to fund themselves without one option just being the best. So in the end, it's a bit like if you're running a company, you also want to diversify in terms of your products or clients to make sure that you have a long-term sustainability, because economics can change or your sponsors can change or just drop off. So yeah, in any case, dependence on just one revenue source is never a good idea.
Thank you so far. Any more other questions or ideas, comments? Maybe someone has a solution at hand?
Oh yeah, please.
Yes.
I like the license that Meta used to publish their latest large language model, which allows, which is publishing open source, allows everybody to use the software, even commercially. But once you reach a certain threshold of users or revenue, then you have to pay. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on that model? Is that a good way, a solution?
For me, for now, it sounds like a really good idea, but I haven't looked into that. So, yeah. Do you know the name of that specific license? Yeah, need to check it out. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for the great talk. I just have a small note for the licensing. It's not really a question. Sorry. I often see projects dual licensing under the GPL v3 and a commercial license because for some reasons or business reasons mostly, some companies really want to avoid the viral aspects of the GPL v3, and that might be an option that works if you have a certain project size and they like your product as so much that they would prefer to pay you rather than open their code.
Mm. Yeah, true.
Okay, I don't see any more comments. So then, thanks again for that great keynote and the likely discussion.